PhD. I'm Gregory Berg. For today's morning show, we are going back into the archives to rebroadcast a conversation about food and the way in which so many Americans have lost their sense of connection to their food. The author is Ann Velisis, and the book is called Kitchen Literacy: How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back, published by Island Press.
Greg.
Your introduction opens with a very good observation about the fact that eating is such a fundamental human activity, which means that our ignorance about the food we eat, that is exactly where it comes from, is so ironic that we would allow ourselves to be so ignorant about something which is so important to us.
Yeah, that's the thing that actually really got me interested in this book. You know, I was hearing more and more troubling news about the food system, but yet when I went to shop at the supermarket, it was as if I had entered an entirely different world. Of course, food is plentiful, cheap, and colorful, and familiar, but somehow, you know, hearing the news, having the different experience at the market, I just started to be struck by this absurdity that I knew so little about what I was eating, what I was putting into my body. And I wondered, how on earth did we get into this everyday cultural situation? You know, we all face it every week at the store. So that was really my curiosity. And so because I'm a historian, I thought it'd be fascinating to go back through time to the kitchens of pre-industrial America and keep my bead exactly on this question of what did cooks know and how did it change as the distance between farms and our kitchens grew?
Right. You call it a drift toward indifference, which I think is well put. And as I read your book, it began to dawn on me that probably one of the reasons we allowed this drift of indifference to occur is because, in a sense, at the time that everybody knew exactly where their food came from, it was just sort of intrinsic to the way we lived. I mean, people didn't have that connection to the food they ate because they thought that connection was important. It's because the circumstances of life prevented it from being any other way.
Right.
And so no wonder we allowed this to kind of slip away from us. We never really, in a sense, consciously had it in our grasp.
Right. Well, I think the thing that's interesting to note is that we used to have the expectation of knowing all sorts of specific things about our food, specific stories and knowledge of place, for precisely the reason you mentioned, because most people's lives used to revolve around producing food from the very basic level, from seed all the way to plate, and not just homemakers, but whole families' lives were really tied to this. And of course, as America urbanized and became industrial, you know, the configuration of our lives totally changed. And yet, I guess, I thought to myself, gosh, did we really have to throw the baby out with the bathwater here too? Did we have to, as our lives changed, did we have to relinquish the expectation or the awareness of where our food comes from?
Hmm.
Because, of course, it strikes me that it's a problem that we don't. There are problems that come from not knowing stuff about our food, basic things about our food.
Well, and we lose some of the fun of it, frankly.
Exactly.
In a sense, one thing that surprised me in your book, among a lot of the really interesting specific information we learn, is that although I think your characterization is very, very much right on, that this is this kind of drift towards indifference, that in fact it has not been a smooth flowing drift, that there have been moments in our history, at least one or two, where people became aware of this and different efforts were made to sort of stem this tide. I mean, we're not just waking up in 2008
right,
as we read your book and being concerned about this for the first time. This concern has been there before. I mean, many, 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 many years ago.
Yeah, and in fact, I was really struck by that and surprised by that, too, because I think the dominant story is this, of our culture, is the sense that the food system became modern and we all embraced it because it's so great. But the reality is that when the food system first started to industrialize, people were very skeptical of the new types of products and the fact that foods were coming from such great distances. you know, for perspective, before things like canned foods, foods were leafy and green, and they had smells, and you could evaluate them with your senses, and then all of a sudden they're in boxes and packages, and you don't really know what you're getting, except by what you read on the label. And so it's a very different, it's a very important transformation in how we experience food.
Well, and that's such a wonderful thing to have brought to life for us, because, of course, now we walk into a supermarket and we're just confronted with cans everywhere and we think nothing of it.
They're utterly familiar. They're just what we, that's what we think of as food now.
Right. And so you help us, you help take us back to that, that moment when Americans for the first time were confronted by metal cans. And I think in the very early days, just pretty much blank metal cans, and that's when they realized we need to stick some labels on, we need to make them bright and have information, and because otherwise people just are not going to feel good about buying these cans and having to trust that something good was inside them.
Right. And another, I think, fun story that I tell over the course of time is really how the development of these kinds of promotional materials and the kinds of things that they tell us. And in fact, they help us to start thinking new things are important about our foods, whereas in the past it may have been that something was in season or that something was from a particular place or even something was homemade. Different new criteria started to become important, that things were sanitary and hygienic, that things had fewer calories, of course. That's a whole thing that happens in the 20th century that is very different. And finally, that things are, in fact, made in factories rather than homemade, that somehow this is more modern and more, new and special than the old way.
Right, and that by things being uniform and entirely predictable, that, you know, that there are certain points in our history where this was the highest ideal. I mean, there was nothing better than Wonder Bread.
Yeah. So it's amazing. And I think the historical perspective also lets us see that maybe this period when we accepted the idea of not really paying attention, of really leaving it to the experts, that also became kind of part of our approach as consumers, that it doesn't have, that that's not the way it's always been, that we've kind of gone into that, and I think that we are, in fact, now, or over the past decades, we've been realizing that there are problems with this system, and that we've got to figure out a new solution. We've got to figure out new ways to know our foods once again. And I think that's what's really exciting now, because many, many more people, I think, are coming to that awareness and becoming involved and interested in way in shopping at farmers markets, for example, and developing more localized food systems once again. It's a very exciting time.
We're speaking with Ann Velises about her book, Kitchen Literacy. Anybody who loves history, I think, is going to absolutely love your book. And I think one of the things that is so striking about it is it helps us realize that one of the most interesting facets of history is the history of ordinary lives, or the way in which ordinary people lived. And for people who think that history is only about great battles and kings and queens and that sort of thing, political coups, that this is another facet of history that is just endlessly fascinating. I should think that it is also not the simplest of matters to be able to find sources of information that tell us this kind of nitty-gritty detail about the everyday lives of ordinary people. Tell us about Martha Ballard and how she left behind her something that is of extraordinary help to you and all of us in understanding this topic.
Well, Martha Ballard was one of the very few women who left behind a diary of the 18th century. I think at that time, few women really had the time or inclination to write, but Martha was rather extraordinary. She was a midwife in the late 1700s and lived in Augusta, Maine, and she kept track of her daily activities, including tremendous details about her everyday life, which included cooking and preparing, hundreds of meals. And what I found most fascinating in by reading through her diary was that I could really see that she knew the stories of her food. For example, from the moment that a turkey hatched, you know, she noted in her diary, turkeys hatched one day, and I would kind of see them appear in her diary through the summer until the fall, when all of a sudden the diary would say, killed turkey and made soup. And I could see this in a number of foods, this way in which she really knew quite specifically the places where the food came from, the stories of how she got the food. And, of course, that's in such stark contrast to what we experience today.
You call it her deep sense of place being a fundamental part of cooking and eating.
Yeah.
Another interesting observation that you make in talking about, actually specifically, Martha's Garden is this whole notion of nature in what we grow in the garden and consume from the garden. And we think of that as an entirely natural thing. You mention, almost as an aside, but it's so fascinating, that there are certainly some people who would look at any kind of agriculture, even the sowing of a garden in one's backyard, as decidedly unnatural, that that you are taking a plot of nature and disrupting it, even if you're not doing it with chemicals and whatever. But, I mean, you are still disrupting what Mother Nature really had planned for that little plot of land.
Yeah, it's one of the threads or themes I explore in my story is how we think about nature all through this history as well. And as I point out, early on, when people are really raising much of their own food, there isn't much of a distinction between what's nature and what's the farm. It's kind of all seen as a whole, and there's this sense in which people work in a natural world, and it's a combination of work and nature, or the natural world, that creates the abundance, what we eat, natural resources. But as America becomes urban, the idea of how we think about nature really changes, and this is what I found fascinating. At the turn of the 20th century, urban Americans who are living in cities, and of course at the time cities are getting smoky and filthy and very crowded, very uncomfortable probably compared to what we have in cities today, they began to look to nature as a refuge. The idea of going to a countryside for a picnic, going out into the natural world as a place apart from their experience in the city. And this idea of nature as something separate, as something that was therapeutic and aesthetic, as opposed to the source of our food, the source of abundance for us all, was a real transition in how Americans came to think about the natural world. And if you think about it, it ultimately kind of gets us into a little bit of a problem in that we start to think about nature as something that can be preserved in parks alone, rather than thinking about it as a system that we all depend on, an ecology that we're connected to through our eating. Of course, some of the problems that we're going to be increasingly facing today with issues like global warming show us that our food system really is dependent on the health of the natural world. And so I think we're going to be coming around full circle to recognizing this more holistic view once again. But to look at it through history and how it changes in the cultural understanding, I found really fascinating.
Hmm. Among the many striking phrases in your book is the title of Chapter 3, Mystifying the Mundane. Just to briefly tell our listeners about what you explore in this chapter. It's one of my favorites in the book.
Yeah, I found that chapter, that was one of my favorite chapters to write, too. What I talk about in that chapter is how some of the basic things that simple things that people expected to know became complicated as the food system expanded. So I talk, for example, specifically about how the idea of place changes with regards to food. Initially, when I opened my book talking about Martha and her garden and her food system in Maine, you know, you'll find notes in her diary such as picked blackberries at Kennedy's till, or, you know, caught fish down in this hole. I mean, there's a very specific sense of place tied to food. But of course, as America's cities grew, food was coming from farther and farther away by railroad. And at the start, people in the newspapers tried to keep track of what was coming to market, and would make notes telling people, you know, oh, the fish are in from South Carolina, the tomatoes are in from Georgia, things like that. But of course, the list got longer and longer and longer and more complicated. And eventually, it turned out that, you know, it kind of became meaningless to have so many lists of places and products. You couldn't make sense of it anymore. And so, you know, by tracing this story, I show how the idea of place really, unfortunately, becomes irrelevant in the way that it used to, compared to the way that it used to be.
And of course, then, in some ways, what takes its place is the brand name.
Yeah.
I mean, that becomes sort of the familiar, friendly hook upon which we can make decisions about what we're going to get and what we're going to eat.
Yeah, the brand name becomes an utter shorthand, and it really does become exactly what we use. And so in some cases, of course, there is a sense of place that might be attached to the brand name, but it might not have anything to do with the actual product anymore. And so that's, I think, a really, you know, interesting story. Another story I tell in that chapter, which I also found incredibly interesting, is what happens with the meat system. When I first start out the book, as I indicated in telling you the story about Martha and the turkeys, you know, people could expect to know actually very specifically about the lives of animals that became meat. They would know things such as the age or the sex and the background of the animals that they were eating. But in the 19th century, like many food businesses, the meat business industrialized to supply growing cities. More and more beef came from the open range of the Great Plains. Animals were shipped by rail, and eventually they were mass butchered in Chicago, and then only the meat was shipped to eastern markets. Now, at first, when this system kind of came into being again, there was skepticism because people were not used to eating animals that were butchered from so far away. And in particular, butchers were opposed to it. They were used to knowing the health of the animal and seeing it before they killed it. That was all part of the traditional knowledge and, you know, wisdom that they carried with them, that they used in their work. However, through this period of transformation, as I said, there was tremendous skepticism. But eventually, you know, the new food system supplied meat at much lower costs than what people were used to. It was corn-fed, which was a new thing, and so it was kind of fatter, and people liked the taste. And, you know, eventually, in a very short time, we became used to the idea of just buying the package of meat. And so I explain how this notion of knowing about the background of the animals that become our meat seems to become totally obsolete.
We don't even think of them as animals anymore.
No.
It's we think of them in just as body parts. And again, it's the kind of thing that is around us and that we tend to entirely take for granted. And the value of your book, of course, is to help us, give us a means to re-examine so much of what we take for granted around us and to maybe come to better understanding. We're speaking with Anne Velisis, the author of Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back. Let's dig a little deeper into this really intriguing question about how foods were advertised, and particularly how, as foods first became encased in boxes and cans and so on, the kinds of decisions that were made in terms of putting things on the labels to entice people to purchase a given food product, and also, I suppose, to curb their hesitancy or their fear of what in fact it might be. Talk for a moment about how important these kind of decisions were.
Well, you know, I found it to be absolutely fascinating to go back and look at some of these early product packages and early promotions to see what were the kinds of information that were imparted to early consumers. And at first, at the very earliest promotions really gave people the traditional kinds of information they expected to know, where something was made, how it was made, in very great detail. You know, a can of corn is made, is canned right next to the field, and why it is that it's important that that's the case. You know, lots of details. And then as you go through time, you realize that that message or that those types of things change, because, of course, the reality of food production as it becomes industrialized is that the details aren't necessarily so appealing anymore. And so then you start seeing just much more images that are more sentimental. One of the things I talk about in my book that I found really interesting was the way advertisers and promoters used beautiful images of nature as a way to sell their foods at this time when people were anxious about foods being made in factories. So one of my favorite examples is for the cereal Shredded Wheat, which of course was made in a factory, but the promotions made much of the fact that it wasn't a factory, it was a conservatory perched on the brink of that romantic icon of nature, Niagara Falls. And so there's beautiful images of Niagara, and in fact the biscuit ovens were powered by the force of Niagara Falls too. So there was this sense that, you know, the vital force of Niagara was being imparted into these little cereal biscuits, and that I think helped to ease people into the idea that factory foods could somehow be naturalized or more comfortable.
Hmm. You talk about that in your chapter called A New Longing for Nature.
Yes.
And we'll return to that in just a moment, because that's, of course, so intriguing, especially given the fact that that's a longing a lot of people have today as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
I want to go back to early labels once again for just something else that I think is interesting. You give us an example of an early label on a jar of something or other that is an example of how once upon a time we really cared about exactly how a food was prepared, and whoever was packaging these foods presumed that the consumer would want to know this. So, for instance, you tell us of an early jar label in which the person reading it would be told that the contents were prepared by straining the seeds and skins from tomatoes and evaporating the watery particles by slow heat. I mean,
right.
all of that on the label. I mean, that runs in a sense, even though our labels contain a fair amount of sort of hard and fast black and white information, it's intriguing to think about this kind of information being a part of food labeling on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah, and another thing from that particular type of can that you're mentioning is the idea of shelf life was mentioned on a can. A lot of those early things say this will keep, this will keep for a long time if you don't open it, basically, or will keep for several months. And that's a new idea, because before canned foods, before these kinds of processed foods, things rotted, and you wouldn't imagine keeping a can of tomatoes or keeping tomatoes all through the winter. So these very basic concepts of things that we now take totally for granted, people had to learn and become accustomed to, and I really found it fascinating to look at that, because it gives us this different perspective that what we think or know about our foods right now is very dynamic and can change again.
Sure. You also remind us that dishonesty is nothing unique to our day. One of the examples you give of really, I mean, it's even more than just sort of deceptive advertising. I mean, it just seems kind of like an outright lie in some respects. You give the example of a package of lard released by the Swift Company. Tell us about that.
Well, I show this picture. It's actually, I think, oleomargarine. Is that what you're talking about, that ad?
You say here on their packages of lard, Swift used images that recapitulated the process of rendering in traditional farm style.
Right,
so apparently there are pictures,
Yeah, so you have this label, and it shows a farmer with a pig, and then it shows him, taking the pig into the barn, and then it shows a cauldron of with a fire under it, which was a way that lard would have been rendered. And so that was the image given. And then, of course, the
reality. So it's kind of like a miniature mural,
right
on the label. Yeah.
I mean, in a lot of this early artwork on labels is actually quite beautiful and interesting, you know. But, of course, at that time already, lard was being produced as a byproduct of a mammoth meat industry, you know, where animals were being mass butchered by the thousands. And lard was coming from factories. And so, again, it was this attempt to make the industrial modern product seem familiar and seem more traditional. And, you know, nowadays we see things like that on packages still. You see a lovely barn on a package of eggs. And, you know, the reality is very few eggs that we buy in the supermarket are going to be coming out of red barns. You know,
right, right.
If any. But I think at that time, in particular, people were not as accustomed to advertising and promotion and didn't, I think there was more of a sense that there was less skepticism. I think people took things for at face value more. And I think we've become more jaded through time about some of the images that we see today, although I think that they're still powerful and potent.
Right. And probably being a bit jaded is a good thing. I mean,
yes.
that we're not quite so easily swayed by a pretty picture.
Exactly.
Let's talk for a moment about oleomargarine. I think, once again, your book does such a great service for us in that a product like this that we just sort of take for granted, that we are so used to having in our lives and on our grocery store shelves, that you take us back to the moment when this first emerged and what a dramatic thing, in fact, it was.
Yes.
Talk for a moment about what was revolutionary about oleomargarine.
Well, the thing about oleo, I mean, the reason it was invented is because it was a cheap substitute for butter, and it was used by armies in Europe to begin with. And then when these big meat factories started, you know, mass-producing meat, they had all these waste products, and they were able to use them to come up with products that they could sell. That's kind of part of the magic of industrialization. And the new products were things like oleomargarine that was made from lard and other parts of the animal and made to look like butter, and it sold for much cheaper. And so, you know, some people saw this as a great way to use the waste products and to provide a cheaper fat substitute, especially for poorer working class people. But people who were accustomed to butter did not like this idea at all, because oleo was often marketed as butter, in fact, or it would come onto the market in the same little wooden tubs that butter was sold in at the time, and it would sell for cheaper. And sometimes it would be labeled as something like butterine, and the I-N-E and butterine would be in tiny letters. And so there was this sense that people were being deceived by this. And in fact, the people that were probably the most angry and organized over this were dairy farmers who were, you know, who had a sense that their livelihoods would be at stake, perhaps. And they organized and, in fact, took the issue to Congress. And it was fascinating to me to go back and read this discourse of congressmen at this time. This is in the 1880s, talking about what's going on here. You know, for the first time, there's this situation where basically I'll try to paraphrase with the what the senator said, you know, human ingenuity for the first time is tricking us. It's tricking our senses. We can no longer tell what's natural and what's not. And I just found that to be a really interesting moment to think about people, you know, seeing this new food as somehow deceptive and troubling.
Well, particularly it tells us something about what food had been in the not too distant past. I mean, if people had thought of food as something familiar and you know where it comes from, although your book points out that even by this point in time, there was already much more distance than there had been. But still, this had to be tremendously disturbing to some people. The idea that something is showing up now on our grocery store shelves and potentially on our dining room tables that is sort of alien somehow.
Yeah, and that's made in factories. One of the points I make at the end of that section, which I found interesting, is that the story of the food matters. You know, the people who were promoting margarine at the time said, hey, it's the same thing. You know, it's animal fat. What's the big difference? You know, they were, you know, trying to say it's equivalent, margarine and butter. And the people who were defending butter, and the traditionalists were saying, well, wait a second, how can it be the same thing? You know, one of them comes from these reeking abattoirs, and the other comes from, you know, a farm. Somebody's doing the work of milking the cow and taking care and making the butter, and how could it be the same?
Right. You know? Also, you should mention to our listeners, in this amazing debate which occurs in the nation's capital, I mean, I should think for one of the first times in the history of the food industry, people were taking out microscopes and looking at margarine and what was really in it. I mean, that gets to be really interesting.
Yeah, there's a wonderful quotation of somebody from the USDA who looks and sees all sorts of, you know, hairs and spores and all sorts of things in margarine because, of course, as I mentioned, it's made from, you know, ground-up fat and various things that are coming out of these big mass butchering plants. And he says there's all this, you know, this could cause disease. We don't know what's in it. It's, you know, raising all sorts of fears. And so it's remarkable. Of course, what went on to happen with margarine is it eventually, it kind of became fashionable for, the vegetable oils became more fashionable than animal oils. And we had the sense that they were healthier. And so, you know, that kind of happened. And the thing that's fascinating now is in recent years, we've had a complete turnaround in with new understanding of trans fats and the fact that they may not, in fact, be very healthy for us, hydrogenated vegetable oils. And so there's sort of a resurgence in believing that butter is actually a better thing for us to be eating. So it's interesting to see these things.
Absolutely. One other quick thing we should mention about this whole margarine conundrum was around the question of color. And the fact that margarine on its own had very little color at all, and it was dyed yellow, so it really did resemble butter. And this, of course, was like a rallying battle cry for those that preferred butter.
Right. If you're going to dye something, I mean, it really does seem like you're trying to deceive people, doesn't it? And that was how they perceived it. And so they were advocating, they were trying to say things like, well, if you're going to dye your product, why don't you dye it a different color? Dye it, you know, red or purple or something else. Butter, yellow belongs to butter.
Did this have lasting consequences? Was this a fairly isolated bone of contention, butter versus margarine? Did it have ramifications farther afield in the production of food?
Well, you know, I think it's really one of the very first times that we had a discourse about this idea of food being made in factories and foods being made in ways that are different from what we do at home. It was really, I think, one of the first national discourses about this. And at the time, as I said, there was lots of skepticism. A lot of traditionalists felt like, well, this is not the direction America should be going in. You know, they really thought about this as a national level of issue. But the more and more that products like this came on the market, more processed foods that were made in factories in ways that homemakers didn't know, with more additives and preservatives, artificial colors, you know, I think the discourse migrated and people started to accept some of it and realize, well, gosh, maybe there is legitimate value to using some preservatives if not. You know, the controversy, I would say, continued. But I think the butter margarine thing, you know, kind of set the stage for that whole ongoing debate. Of course, butter and margarine, I mean, that debate over coloring, it went on through much of the 20th century. It lasted.
We're speaking with Anne Velasis about her book, Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back. We touched earlier in the interview on how this desire to get back to nature, a new longing for nature, which we see so much of now with the great resurgence of interest in things like organic farming and so on, that this is not unique to our own day. And you talk extensively about how there was a similar sort of movement right around the turn of the last century.
Yeah, I found found that to be utterly remarkable because, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, it seems like it's so much a part of our time right now, but about 100 years ago, and think about the context, America's cities were really growing, and cities back then had a lot of problems that we don't have today. I mean, they were smoky and polluted. They were dirty because, of course, there weren't cars. There were horses, and so there were street sweepings. Indoor plumbing wasn't universal. I mean, they were crowded, filthy, and smelly, and, you know, all sorts of things like that. And people, especially middle and upper class people who lived in cities, started at that time to look to nature as sort of an ideal and as a refuge, as a therapeutic place to go, you know, to go to the country for a picnic, to get away from the city. And and because of that that kind of thing that was happening, you can see that when it came to food too. And I found that really interesting. People started to question you know, food that was being made in boxes and packages and such, and wanting foods to be like they were in the past. One of the things that also happened at the time, was, which I found fascinating, was there was really this arise of a nature study in school garden movement at that time. People realized that children growing up at the late 19th century would be the largest generation ever to grow up living in cities, and as they saw it, completely disconnected from nature, completely disconnected from any understanding of where plants grow and how foods are raised. And, you know, they regarded that as a very serious issue because, you know, before then, most people had grown up with some awareness of these things or some even firsthand experience. So they started these school gardens. I have an amazing photograph in my book that I found. I just found it to be so moving of children in New York City with these factories all around behind them with smokestacks and smoke. And there they are out in a little plot of dirt trying to get things to grow. And it's and if you think about it, at that time, too, there were no child labor laws, so some and not public transportation. So some children really had literally, you know, spent a lot of time working in the city and had never been outdoors in what we would now think of as nature.
And an early example of this nature study movement.
Yeah.
What goes around comes around.
Yeah.
in the next chapter of your book called The Rise of the Modern Food Sensibility, in a sense, this longing for nature ultimately kind of gets displaced by some different priorities, and some of them led by a certain Dr. Harvey Wiley. Tell us what an enormous difference he made in the way consumers looked at food and the things that they ultimately became most concerned about.
Well, Harvey Wiley is just a remarkable character, and he's, I think, a real hero in American history, and I'm surprised that more of us don't really know about who he is. He was he's the chief of the Bureau of Chemistry, which was the predecessor of the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. And he was an interesting guy because he was around at this pivotal time of transformation. And he had grown up on a farm in Indiana himself. And then yet he found himself being asked to look at what was happening to foods and what was the and he didn't like what was happening to foods. He was really skeptical about artificial colors and preservatives in particular. So around the turn of the century, he convened a group of healthy young men, and he fed them meals with increasing doses of preservatives added, and he studied what happened to their health. He monitored what their excretions and what happened to their bodies, and of course, because he was using pretty big doses, they started having troubles. Their esophaguses were burning, and they had awful stomach problems. And of course, at the time, some of the preservatives that were being used were things like formaldehyde, which I associate that with high school biology dissections. And so, as he was doing this experiment, it became very popular. The press picked it up and talked about it quite a lot. The group became known as the Poison Squad, and it really elevated this question to a national scale. You know, what are preservatives something that we really need, or are they something that are being added to deceive consumers into buying?
And again, this is it's so interesting in that, that we have lots of people who think about this and are concerned about this now. And I think many of them feel like this is a brand new concern and that that's not the case at all.
Right. It's not the case at all. And so Harvey Wiley ended up elevating this concern really to a national level. And he went on to spearhead what would be the passage of the first federal food legislation, the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906. And that was really the first act that set standards for hygienic standards for food production in America. And at the time, we had lots of small factories that were kind of helping and working to feed urban populations, but they didn't all know what they were doing. It was fascinating for me when I was doing some of my research at, actually, it was the Smithsonian Institution and looking at some old labels, old promotions, to realize that there were dozens and dozens and dozens of ketchup factories in America in the late 19th century. You know, nowadays, there's really only probably one big ketchup maker. And part of it was this regulation, which, in fact, had the effect of closing down a lot of small, haphazard, and sometimes fly-by-night producers. But the other effect was to make food sanitary and start making it more uniform. So when a consumer bought something, she could know that it was going to be healthy or, you know, not unsafe, and that it was going to be sort of the same as the next product, the next time she bought it.
Right, which, of course, has its benefits, and of course, has its drawbacks as well. And we should mention that, you know, as you talk about Mr. Wiley and all that he railed against, he was particularly concerned with deceptive advertising, and carnation evaporated milk was one of the things that bothered him the most.
Yeah, when he after he ended up having to resign from his position, probably because he was such a traditionalist and was raising these questions again and again, and he ended up working for one of the women's magazines and basically working as an investigative reporter. And so he was annoyed by the Carnation's old slogan, which was the milk from contented cows. And so he decided to go out and for himself see exactly what the situation was with these cows. And the company advertised that the milk came from beautiful green fields on the slopes of mountains in the Pacific Northwest in Washington State, which is, of course, where Carnation started. But by the time Wiley was doing his investigation, the company had grown, and milk was being, in fact, canned in a number of places in Wisconsin as well as in Washington. And he went out and saw the cows, and he just said they looked as sorry as any other lot he'd seen. And he just, didn't think it was right for a company to be saying their milk is coming from Washington and cows were happy when, in fact, they were coming from places all over the country and they looked the same as before. And you know, I think that this is interesting because, of course, nowadays we don't, you know, we sort of have this sense that, well, it's an ad. It's, you know, we don't expect it to be exactly true necessarily. But at that time, I think Wiley felt like it was very important for ads and for information that consumers were getting to be exactly correct.
Right.
Accurate, you know. So
you point out that this was a time when food ads operated not by imparting information, but by evoking emotion. And Mr. Wiley, for one, was really troubled by that. And, of course, as well he should be. I mean, we all need to be aware of the fact that the ads we see really exist as much as anything to hit our buttons.
Yeah. And I found that to be, that's another, I think, interesting thing that I was able to bring out and study in my book is really, as I think I mentioned, you know, advertising really cut its teeth as an industry, helping Americans to ease into these new ways of eating foods, because the food industry and the advertising industry kind of grew up together. And so I was able to really study the history of advertising and look at what advertisers found, like what worked, what didn't work, and how their own thinking about how to convince Americans what to eat evolved. And so it did change and migrate through that period. And the things that seemed so important to Wiley and at the turn of the century, by the 1920s, you know, ads were using entirely different motifs and tropes. One of the ones I mentioned in the book that I think is fascinating is an an ad in the 1920s, and it shows a group of scientists, four men in white jackets with test tubes, and you know, the top of the ad says new formula number 493, and it's an ad for a can of baked beans. And the idea is, of course, that you know, these men in suits that have spent 4 years and $100,000 to perfect a new formula, not a recipe, is better than what, you know, mothers have been making forever. And that and that became part of what advertisers realized they had to do to sell the new foods, is to denigrate old foods, to make the old traditional things that mothers had always been making seem somehow inferior and old-fashioned.
That is so amazing, because, of course, now that seems like a very foolish way to go about it. But in a different time and place,
yeah,
that was exactly the way to make something alluring. In the same way that in the 1950s, making food seem like they're sort of part of the space age,
right,
was the thing that made them so appealing, even though now we look at some of those early TV dinners and we just can hardly imagine people wanting to put them in their mouths. We have only just a couple minutes, really, to touch on something that's much more important than that. In the chapter called The Covenant of Ignorance, where you talk about a big moment, September 11th, 1916, when something opens up in Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah, that was basically America's first supermarket opened up on that day. And you know, I don't think that anybody realized at the time, but of course the supermarket went on to become really one of the pivotal institutions of the 20th century, because it really changed the way that Americans got their food, and really not only got their food, but could understand it and think about it. And that's, of course, you know, since that was kind of the focus of my book, I found it fascinating to find that at the time, you know, people were thrilled about supermarkets, about the fact that they had all these novel new products, and that food seemed cheaper and were cheaper in many cases. But the thing that was the troubling thing that they wrote about was that there were so many products that you couldn't know these things anymore. You couldn't expect to know about your foods anymore. And you know, I think that that's a really interesting thing to note, that at that moment that people were recognizing, gosh, what are we going to do now? And so the idea of going to a shorthand, using brand names, or, you know, relying again more on labels is what people had to do. And ultimately, I talk about how what people had to do at that time, and what people opted to do, is just kind of accept the fact that they were going to relinquish the work of knowing their food, or even the expectation of knowing about their food, to somebody else. That was kind of part of the specialization of the industrial economy. Shoppers shopped, and people who produced foods, and you know, shoppers didn't ask questions, and the food producers didn't necessarily provide answers, and that's kind of, that seemed like a good way to go at the time, and that's what I call the covenant of ignorance. It just seems as though you know, shoppers seemed to be getting what they want, what they needed. It was easy, and no one had any reason to suspect that there were any problems.
You have an interesting illustration in this chapter of ad or something involving Piggly Wiggly grocery stores. And up at the top is this headline: armed with new knowledge, sure of her new skill, the woman of today has made this plan of household buying a nationwide vogue. And that is, you know, the typical housewife becoming an adept shopper. That's what this was all about, more than anything.
It's a total new skill that people have to learn. And I guess that's the thing I also found just utterly remarkable, because nowadays we just think everybody goes to the supermarket. It's not a skill. We just do it, you know.
Sure.
But when it was new, you had to learn how to shop in this new way of picking from thousands of products.
And you also help us kind of imagine what that would have felt like to be that woman who doesn't go up to a counter and ask for somebody manning the counter to reach up on a shelf and bring down something for her. But there she is, walking down these aisles. I mean, aisles which to us now would seem tiny and cramped and not all that well stocked. But I mean, it must have been an amazing experience.
Yeah, it was a total, a very big transition in everyday life.
Anne Velisis, and her fascinating book again is titled Kitchen Literacy, How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back, published by Island Press. Tomorrow on the morning show, I should say Monday on the morning show, I look forward to speaking with Craig Gall, music director of the Kenosha Pops Band. We'll be talking about their current